taking a look at the COVID-19 outbreak and its impact on society, global environment, and prevention.
Do routine antihypertensive medications increase the risk of COVID infection?
Should we adopt a strategy called controlled avalanche to increase herd immunity to COVID-19?
And the impact of social distancing on COVID-19 spread.
That's what we're talking about this week on Double T Health Watch, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a medical journalist in Baltimore.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I'd like to start with this one that came from MedRxiv, the preprint server that takes a look at this thing that I served up as controlled avalanche. Basically, it's a modeling study. I thought it was really, really interesting. One reason, because it came from Israel, which is a place that I would think would be really sensitive to the idea that you might expose your population on purpose to a pathogen and see what happens. In this case, what they did was develop a modeling strategy that compared mitigation of the entire population, the controlled avalanche strategy that I'll describe in just a bit, and a couple other modifications of that to see, well, what would happen? How quickly could we develop herd immunity and then reopen the economy? They basically showed that compared to mitigation of the whole population, if we had this controlled avalanche strategy that would intentionally infect people who are thought to be at low risk for a lot of complications of COVID-19, they would reduce the maximum number of people who needed ICUs by 62% and decrease the time required for release of 50% of the low-risk population by more than 2 months. And this with a really remarkable rebound, if you will, of the economy. So what's controlled avalanche? Controlled avalanche is asking people voluntarily, are you willing to be infected, and assessing beforehand the constellation of things that might put them at higher risk for severe infection. Things like we know already, obesity, diabetes, pre-existing heart disease. They model this that if about 81.5% of people said, sure, we're going to be able to do this, we're happy to be infected, you could infect them in one of two ways, either in a laboratory kind of setting or just opening them up and letting somebody be in their midst and let infection kind of come along on its own. And as I said, if this actually happened, it would reduce the time to the development of herd immunity and the need for intensive care unit care.
Elizabeth, you're right. It's unusual this would come from Israel, because what do they know about controlled avalanches? Now, for our listeners that aren't skiers, what that means is that a common practice at ski resorts is they'll trigger small little avalanches in an attempt to prevent single large catastrophic avalanches. And what you're describing is giving little pockets of individuals the infection over a controlled period of time to prevent infection of the larger group that is at greater risk. So this works only based upon three assumptions. One is that once you develop infection, you're immunized from further reinfection. Secondly is that the period of infectiousness is fairly limited, less than a couple weeks. And the third assumption is the case fatality rate among individuals who get infected is fairly low. And in this particular group, the people that were enrolled in the controlled avalanche volunteer group are those under the age of 50, and their mortality is less than 0.2%. So under those circumstances, this model looks like it holds up.
Interestingly, of course, they also suggest that governments obviously need to be the purveyors of this whole strategy, but that they also develop a compensation scheme for those who do develop fatal infection as a result of participation.
Yeah, there are obviously ethics involved with this. And you mentioned one is it has to be voluntary. Secondly, is you're only exposing low-risk patients and keeping the high-risk patients out. But then, as you alluded to, there'll be some individuals that do have a fatal event, albeit 2 out of 1,000, and how to compensate those. But one of the things it doesn't address, Elizabeth, is we don't know what the long-term consequences of the infection are. Death is obviously the hardest endpoint, but do people have continued lung issues? Or does exposure to COVID a second time increase the risk that they'll have more severe complications?
I do have to say, however, that the patience of the population worldwide with this isolation and sheltering at home is really wearing thin. And there are people who have made suggestions, like it used to be popular to have a chickenpox party and expose your children, because if it was going to happen anyway, why not just do it? And there's even a part of me that feels like that. If it's inevitable that I'm going to end up with infection, why not just get infected and be done with it?
Well, certainly if you do it in a controlled circumstance, you're able to make sure that you have proper resources, hospital resources, protective resources for the people that surround the individual as well. So this thought really does have some merit. And as you suggested, some support.
Let's turn to the New England Journal of Medicine. There are three different studies, all taking a look at this issue of hypertension drugs and cardiovascular outcomes.
To have three articles published simultaneously in New England Journal on the same topic is really unusual. So let me take a step back and say that the virus, we know, attaches to cells in the respiratory tract by attaching what's called an angiotensin converting enzyme 2 receptor, or ACE2. Some of the medications we routinely use in antihypertensive therapy are ACE inhibitors, or angiotensin receptor blockers, ARBs. And we know that when we give those to individuals, they inhibit activity, and it increases the number of receptors on the cells. So there was some genuine concern that individuals that took ACE inhibitors or ARBs would be at an increased risk of getting COVID infection, and secondly, would be having more severe disease. And by the way, we know that people that have hypertension are the group that's at highest risk of having mortality associated with COVID infection. So these three studies try to address that question. Overall, all three studies, and I'll kind of group them together to talk about them, there were almost 60,000 patients involved. Two of the studies were observational studies. One of them was a population-based case control study. And they tried to address, do people on ACE inhibitors have an increased risk of COVID infection? Two, are they at an increased risk of having severe disease? And three, does it increase the risk of mortality? Based upon these three studies, and they all give the same results, there's no increased risk of infection with people who take ACE inhibitors. Those that are already taking ACE inhibitors and get infected, there's no increased severity of disease, and there's no increased mortality. Now, one of the studies did have enough information to say what is associated with mortality, and these were the factors. Age greater than 65, just about doubled your risk of mortality. If you had coronary artery disease, it increased the risk almost threefold. Heart failure, almost twofold. Cardiac arrhythmias, twofold. Chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, threefold. And current smoking increased the risk almost twofold. Good news for those people that have hypertension and need to take ACE inhibitors, no increased risk of infection, severity of disease, or mortality associated with the use of these medications.
And that really is good news because, of course, we know that hypertension is also a killer, maybe a more long-term killer, but still a killer. Let's turn to a journal that we have never talked about before. And this is one of these, I'm very interested in all of the people who are paying attention to the COVID-19 pandemic and its multitude of impacts. This is a journal called The Science of the Total Environment. And what these authors did was take a look at the pandemic, its effects on society, the global environment, and prevention. They reviewed pretty extensively what's known, and actually they were very accurate. It taught me something, that coronaviruses actually belong to a large, diverse family of viruses, and there's four genera that are alpha, beta, gamma, and delta, which I didn't know. And the SARS-CoV-2 and its close relatives are beta coronaviruses. So just one more piece of information for the nerds among us. They took a look at the economic impact of the pandemic so far, and they looked at Canada, Germany, France, the UK, Italy, and the United States to see what industries were being impacted most by the outbreak right now. And unsurprisingly, the ones impacted the least were transport and some kinds of manufacturing. But it basically shows that everyone is having impacts. Unsurprisingly, also travel, hotels, and restaurants are impacted very severely. They did look also at the upside of the pandemic and illustrated once again that something we've talked about, that particulate matter has declined precipitously. that we're also seeing vast improvements in water all over the globe as a result of humans not moving around so much and not presumably polluting so much. They say that there are things we can take away from this. One thing is forestation, that we need to protect existing forests and make sure that we reforest where possible, because it seems clear that this pandemic resulted from a virus that's been endemic in animals for a while, and they say bats. So if we protect their environment and don't integrate so much with them, probably we won't have the same kind of level of exposure to those sorts of pathogens moving forward. And of course, they also finger human population growth, global wildlife trade, as things that need to also be scrutinized really carefully and controlled in order to avoid this sort of a situation in the future.
Pretty much every country, developing and underdeveloped, will experience a decrease in GDP as a result of the pandemic virus and the social isolation. In Germany, transportation and manufacturing is more affected than it is, for example, in France or the United Kingdom. In all countries, professional and real estate services will substantially decline, and retail and wholesale trade substantially decreases as well. You hate to say there's a silver lining in this, but many cities that have never seen clean air before are seeing a decrease in pollution because of a decrease in personal transportation and manufacturing that uses fossil fuel as well.
And long-term improvements in health, I would suggest.
That's kind of a mixed bag. On the one hand, we have an acute decrease in health for many individuals. But you're right, if we can see a continued decrease in pollution, we can use this to say, listen, we can finally have cleaner air and do things that promote that, then the overall health will be better. We decrease inflammation, decrease hypertension, decrease diabetes, decrease coronary disease, and obviously decrease lung disease as well.
Let's turn back to MedRxiv, the preprint server, for your final one.
This is an interesting study. It looked at the impact, this is modeling, of social distancing on COVID-19 spread, specifically in the state of Georgia. They did what's called an agent-based simulation model. They simulated different scenarios. The first is that COVID infection would hit and there'd be no intervention. The second is that there would be school closures, and we know that's already happened. The third is that there would be sheltering in place where the household member who has been exposed or has COVID would stay at home. And the last would be voluntary quarantine. And that is every member of the household would stay at home until all the symptoms were gone away. When they looked at the combination of a shelter in place followed by voluntary quarantine, it reduced the number of peak infections from 180,000, which was no intervention, to below 80,000. And it also delayed the peak from April to June or later. Now, what that meant is they were less likely to exhaust hospital resources. And by the way, if you want to delay that even further, what they did was they increased sheltering in place from 4 weeks to 5 weeks, and that yielded about a 3 to 14% decrease in cumulative infection and about a 5% decrease in fatality rates.
And I would add to that the CDC's extension of even when you're presumably convalescent, not 7 days, but 10 days, that just came out.
Yep, and here's the latest CDC recommendation. If you try to culture the virus 10 days after the symptoms have started, you really can't do it. Now, that's assuming that you've had 72 hours where you've been symptom-free, no fevers, without the use of medications, and your respiratory symptoms have gotten better.
On that note, we'll no doubt be talking more about COVID-19 next week. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.